KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. An enormous change approved this week by the New Mexico legislature. It overhauls state liquor regulations in an effort to invigorate the hospitality industry. The measure would legalize liquor deliveries when accompanied by food and expand restaurant alcohol licenses that meet local ordinances to include not only beer and wine, but also spirits with a 10 p.m. cutoff. Tastings would also be allowed at craft distilleries. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham set the legislation as a priority at the start of the legislative session. To local politics now, and the Las Cruces City Council this week looked at proposed changes to the election process in the city. Madison Staten has our report.
Las Cruces City Clerk Christine Rivera recommended that the Las Cruces City Council implement updates to key election procedures, including a transition to an electronic system for prospective candidates and a focus on ranked choice voting education. Councilor Joanna Bencomo says that transitioning to an electronic system will help to increase election transparency, as the documents can be made easily available to the public online.
I definitely think we're running some outdated elections in the city. For being such an awesome city, I think it's a little outdated. So I think those online platforms are really incredible. And honestly, I think they add definitely to the transparency of elections, which I believe should be fully transparent.
The city is also working to provide education on ranked choice voting, a system first implemented locally during the 2019 election cycle. A new campaign is already in development, working to provide information in both Spanish and English on various media platforms. Rivera also asked the City Council to think about future policy changes, such as reinstating the petition process previously required for City Council and mayoral candidates.
How the petition process previously worked was that you would need to have 25 signatures of registered voters in your district if you were running for a district seat, or 150 signatures of anybody in the city to run for mayor. So we removed this. As you saw in the 2019 election, when we removed that, we did have more candidates who did run for office.
Assistant City Attorney Robert Cabello says that the petition process was eliminated following the adoption of the New Mexico Local Election Act.
It was passed in March 18, 2018. That actually obviously brought a lot of uniformity to local elections in the state. At that time, it did away with our nominating petitions. There were a second set of changes in 2019 to the Local Election Act that brought back, it gave back local communities the petition process.
The majority of City Council members indicated they would support reinstating a signature policy, but both Councilor Bencomo and Councilor Tessa Beda-Stuvi say the need for signatures isn't necessary. Bencomo emphasized the election process should be as open as possible.
Honestly, for a really long time, elections have been very exclusive. They've been really reserved for, historically across the country, wealthier people. And honestly, I don't necessarily think that a candidate being able to collect a certain amount of signatures says whether they're more committed or not. I think sometimes it could say you raised more money and you hired more people to collect signatures for you.
Mayor Ken Miyagashima was a fierce advocate for reinstating the petition process, saying it would benefit serious challengers looking to run for mayor.
I mean, it's good for the incumbent. It doesn't help the challengers any. Not that I'm here to help challengers, but it doesn't help the challengers any because they can't get their word in edgewise because there's so many that they can that have to go through it. A fourth of them aren't even serious candidates. This maybe was on their bucket list to do, and then that's it. So I think having signatures, I would support it. I think that the 25 for council and 100 for mayor is fine.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
A funeral procession was held this morning for Las Cruces Public Schools Superintendent Karen Trujillo. And this week, Las Cruces police announced no charges will be filed against the driver in the crash that claimed her life. Traffic investigators learned a Nissan Quest minivan was traveling west on Edgewood when it struck Trujillo, who was walking her two dogs. Police say the 18-year-old driver, the sole occupant of that minivan, remained on scene and has been cooperative with authorities. Police say that the driver claimed that his direction of travel was toward the setting sun, making his ability to avoid the crash difficult or impossible. Investigators say the minivan was traveling within a safe range of speed for the roadway. And police say in the investigation, they found Trujillo was walking in the roadway and in the same direction of travel as the minivan. Investigators also believe Trujillo was wearing earbuds and was likely unable to hear the vehicle approaching. Because no charges have been filed, the Las Cruces Police Department says they will not publicly release the name of the driver. The nation's chief energy regulator has started investigating what went wrong with the Texas power grid during last month's winter storm. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider has been following this, and he says the new head of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is determined to act on any findings.
Richard Glick, chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, said Texas ignored FERC's recommendations to weatherize its grid after the last big freeze in 2011. Speaking at the CERAWeek International Energy Conference, Glick said he's determined not to let that happen again.
Somehow throughout the process, those recommendations ended up turning into just guidance for generating plants. And in a market like Texas, which is very competitive, one generator is not going to voluntarily make the changes necessary to weatherize their equipment. If another competitor doesn't do that, it'll put them at a disadvantage. So unfortunately, nothing happened, and then we saw the results of that a few weeks ago.
Glick said FERC's report should be complete by the end of the summer and that the commission will act on its findings. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Well, of course, last month's big freeze left thousands of Texans without running water as they waited to get busted pipes repaired. As you might guess, there is now a huge demand for plumbers. And as Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval found, many of those skilled workers are immigrants.
For the last 2 weeks, Houston plumber Eduardo Dolande has been working long hours to help repair pipes in homes and businesses. He says in his 21 years as a plumber,
I've never seen that much damage in homes. Never.
Dolande says just in his neighborhood, he's helped around a dozen families with their pipes as a favor. He says the destruction looks like something out of a movie.
It's just wet sheetrock everywhere, and then all the insulation that is up in the attic, it was on the floor. And it just looked horrible.
One of the damaged homes was his own. He points to his bathroom ceiling, where he cut holes to repair the pipes above.
We already been working on it. This is all the stuff that I had to open. I had to open holes just to fix all the leaks that I had. I also have some here.
He says his neighborhood in Cypress was also hit hard by Hurricane Harvey. But the freeze was worse because it took people by surprise.
No power, no water. People get desperate over that.
Texas' largest insurer, State Farm, has reported more than 40,000 claims in the state related to the winter weather. That's 10 times the total number of burst pipe claims they saw nationally in 2020. Immigrant workers, like Dolande, who's from Panama, are critical to repairing that damage.
As people are trying to build back, they're trying to repair their houses, they're trying to figure out how to survive the damage. Immigrants are playing outsized roles in so many of the professions that are essential to Texas economy. And you saw that during the pandemic as well.
That's Jeremy Robbins. He directs the New American Economy think tank, which found in Houston around 40% of plumbers and more than half of construction workers are foreign-born. Robbins says the share is even higher when you look at labor-intensive jobs.
Right. So if you look at drywall installers or ceiling tile installers and tapers, more than 75% of them nationwide are immigrants.
Stephen Scarborough with the Center for Houston's Future says without immigrants, these lengthy repairs would take even longer.
You know, imagine all these stories you've heard of how long people are waiting for plumbers and increase that by 37%.
Though these immigrant workers are essential to storm recovery in Houston, Scarborough says many come from communities that tend to be disproportionately impacted by catastrophic events.
So there were a lot of studies done in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey that found that immigrant households were almost twice as likely to report job or income loss after Harvey than non-immigrant households.
And more recently, a Rice University survey found nearly two-thirds of Hispanic immigrants in Houston could not come up with $400 to pay for an emergency expense. Scarborough says these families are also less likely to reach out for aid in a crisis. Eduardo Dolande, who came to the U.S. from Panama in his early 20s, says he hopes people can see that immigrants like him, including those without legal status, are helping the city rebuild.
So we are everywhere. I mean, we're helping everybody, whether they say they don't need us or they don't want to accept it. It is so obvious, you know.
Dolande says it only makes sense for his hardworking colleagues to have the chance to become citizens like he did. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
Well, the big freeze in Texas, just the latest example of the incredible importance and contribution of immigrants in our workforce. And support is growing in Texas for Dreamers who live here under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. That's according to a Texas Tribune University of Texas survey. 63% of likely voters said immigrants brought illegally to the U.S. as children should be allowed to stay. UT pollster Jim Henson co-directed the survey.
When children are involved, immigration attitudes get less draconian, particularly among Republicans who otherwise have very restricted views about immigration.
72% of Republicans polled said undocumented immigrants in general should be immediately deported. 78% of Democrats opposed immediate deportation. Well, El Paso is receiving migrants from the Rio Grande Valley. As KERA's Mallory Falk reports, they will stay at a local shelter or a space where they can quarantine if COVID positive before moving on to other parts of the country.
The southern border is still closed to most migrants and asylum seekers under a public health order known as Title 42. But some people have been released into the Rio Grande Valley, and now some are being flown to other parts of the border to help avoid overcrowding.
It appears that the government will be sending migrants from the south of Texas to the community here in the borderlands.
Dylan Corbett with the Hope Border Institute says about 270 people will arrive in El Paso each day.
These are migrants who have been apprehended at the border and are for the most part, asylum-seeking families that they're paroling into the United States.
This is in addition to the small group of asylum seekers El Paso receives each day who were previously enrolled in the Remain in Mexico program as the Biden administration unwinds that Trump-era policy. On Monday, several members of Congress, including El Paso Representative Veronica Escobar, sent a letter to Governor Greg Abbott urging him to accept federal funds for testing migrants for COVID-19 and quarantining those who test positive. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Lots of health news this week, and we begin with another push to expand Medicaid in Texas, something New Mexico did years ago. New Mexico, like most states, expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. The Medicaid rolls have grown in the state during the pandemic. Recent numbers show 43% of New Mexicans receive health care through Medicaid. And there's a push for Texas to greenlight expansion as well. A majority of Texans support expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, according to a poll released by the Episcopal Health Foundation. Elena Marks is CEO of that Houston-based group.
69% of Texans are in favor of Medicaid expansion, and that's up from 64% a year ago.
Polling data shows among Democrats, 86% favored expansion, along with 75% of independents. But among Republicans, only 39% back it. Texas is one of just 12 states that has not yet expanded Medicaid, foregoing billions of dollars in federal money that could be going into the Lone Star State. And Texas has the highest uninsured rate and number of uninsured people in the U.S. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. The pandemic has prevented families from being with their loved ones as they die in hospitals. On the Texas-Mexico border, some find comfort in so-called memory bears, teddy bears for grieving families handcrafted by a woman in Juarez. KTEP's Angela Cocherga reports.
The sewing machine hums in a Juarez home where Herendira Guerrero stitches together memories.
Camisas, blusas, pijamas, trajes deportivos.
She takes material from shirts, pajamas, team uniforms, a piece of clothing worn by someone who died, handpicked by a relative who wants to remember that person.
Un pedacito, un poquito de la esencia.
It's a little bit of the essence from their loved ones, Guerrero says. She transforms that clothing into custom teddy bears, memory bears, for families prevented from being with their dying loved ones at hospitals because of COVID restrictions.
Donde no ha habido una despedida.
There hasn't been a goodbye, says Guerrero. In the past year, she's made more than 100 memory bears and has a growing waiting list of orders from both sides of the border.
Que te conmueve tremendamente.
She's moved by the reactions of her customers when they pick up their bears.
Lo utilicé, pues, como un depósito de dolor.
Claudia Araceli Ramirez says she used a memory bear to cope with her pain. The lack of grieving rituals and a proper funeral made it hard to accept her 70-year-old father's death from COVID in October. Her memory bear comes from Lorenzo Ramirez's favorite plaid jacket. The bear became a sounding board for the things she didn't get to say to comfort her father as he died in a Juarez hospital. Ramirez wanted to say that they would take care of her mother, that he could continue on his path and not to worry. Gina Ramos did not get a chance to say goodbye to her father either.
My dad was a very, very lovely man.
He was hospitalized in December after a heart attack.
It's a blue shirt that I gave it to him on his birthday.
Her memory bear is made from that indigo-colored shirt. 52-year-old Jose Ramos wore it when he blew out the candles on his last birthday cake.
We have a picture of this day with this shirt. So it's my favorite photo with him.
She's comforted by his memory bear and the message stitched onto the cloth.
It says in Spanish, esta prenda que solía usar.
In English, this is clothing I used to wear. Every time you hug the bear.
I want you to know that I'm here with love, Dad. Que ahí estoy. Con amor, papá.
I'm Angela Cocherga in Ciudad Juarez.
Well, after waiting for some time, people in our region are getting the notification. It's time for your COVID-19 vaccination. Some thoughts from commentator Peter Goodman.
A pre-dawn text announced your COVID-19 vaccination appointment is at 1:30 p.m. Convention Center. It told me to fill out an online medical questionnaire. Nope. Hadn't been vaccinated, wasn't pregnant or likely to be, and had no known allergies. I read the Pfizer and Moderna warnings. Outside the convention center, there were plenty of cars and plenty of police, National Guard, fire department folks, and volunteers to make sure I stayed in my car to answer questions before joining the long, physically distanced line inside. The vaccines, Johnson & Johnson, were late. Looked like a long wait. Felt mildly disappointed it was the J&J vaccine, but was happy to take what I got. Once the vaccine doses arrived, the line moved quickly, with 12 stations rapidly vaccinating us. Everyone was quite pleasant. Mild pinch, then I was directed to the 15-minute waiting area as a precaution. Didn't see anyone in pain or distress. All was carefully organized. No unknowns, no ambiguities, no unnecessary delays. Vaccine was late, but had only arrived in state the previous day. Health department, governor, and our community deserve praise and appreciation. It was a non-event, not something to worry about. Scientists have said, take the vaccine you're offered. Some people worry about the J&J vaccine because its efficacy rate against mild cases is 72%. To put that in context, flu vaccines range from 20 to 60%. All three COVID-19 vaccines protect extremely well against serious cases. That's what really matters. And because J&J's testing was more recent, with new variants of the virus around, it actually seems an open question whether or not the Pfizer or Moderna does better against mild cases than J&J. The J&J requires just one shot because a dose is stronger. Pfizer and Moderna are sometimes effective after just one shot, but efficacy is more certain with two. I will not soon change my behavior. I wore a mask more for others than for myself, and because it seemed the right thing to do. Nothing's changed. Vaccinated people may still carry enough virus in the nose to infect others with a maskless sneeze, and full immunity occurs 2 weeks after the shot. We owe it to vulnerable friends, lovers, neighbors, and strangers, and to local businesses, to avoid contributing to higher numbers here. Keeping numbers low can save lives and expedite reopenings. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is nutty to let his lust for political popularity lead him to abandon the mask requirement early. It may turn out okay, given the ramped-up vaccinating, though Texas is slower than most states, but it's callous and just plain dumb. Occasionally a football player on a long touchdown run starts celebrating before he actually reaches the end zone and gets the ball knocked loose by someone's desperate dive. This virus has taken too damned many lives. Please register, get vaccinated, but don't send your brain on vacation.
And Peter, we are glad you got your shots. Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. Well, starting this week, an extremely controversial decision. It made national and even international news. The mask mandate in Texas disappeared. What should you do to keep your risk of infection low? Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie says just keep doing what public health experts have been telling you to do for a year.
First, keep wearing masks. Double mask if you can, because more contagious COVID variants are circulating in Texas. UT Health School of Public Health epidemiologist Dr. Caitlin Jettolina says she'd also advise you to keep ordering curbside.
You can do to-go meals still. I would certainly not sit in the restaurant, especially if it's full 100% capacity. I wouldn't enter businesses that aren't enforcing the mask rule for their business. And I would stay socially distanced.
All five of the more contagious variants of the COVID virus have been detected in Texas. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Also on the Health Watch this week, many who survive COVID-19 go back to life as normal, but a few experience lingering symptoms that go on for weeks, months, or longer. UT Southwestern Medical Center has created a rehab program for the so-called long haulers. KERA's Sam Baker talked about this with the center's Kathleen Bell, who says there is little, if any, rhyme or reason about who becomes a COVID long hauler.
That is really the $64,000 question. Certainly for some of the people who have been hospitalized for long periods of time and had been intubated on a ventilator, some of those people, for instance, have what we call super infections, so that they can get bacterial infections on top of the viral infections and have actual serious lung damage. We see people who have holes in their lung tissue from the bacterial infection. So, you know, some of those people, it's, you know, fairly obvious why they're having problems. We suspect people react to inflammation in different ways. Some people seem to react with pretty flagrant inflammation and persistent inflammation. And we think that those are the people who really are having these persistent tissues. Someday we're going to understand kind of the genomics behind why some people react and some people don't. But right now, it's a little bit of a crapshoot.
UT Southwestern has come up with a rehab program for long haulers. What exactly does a patient go through?
The first thing we do is really try to get a really good history of what their whole process has been, whether they've been in the hospital or whether they've been home, really going into depth about, you know, how long they were in bed, how long they were isolated. And then depending on what their needs are, we may have them see a physical therapist who will work on things like breathing exercises, their dizziness, or their ability to tolerate exercise while they're monitoring their oxygen levels and while they're monitoring, for instance, their pulse rate, so they can do it safely under supervision. If they're having problems with their cognition, we may have them work with a speech therapist who's working on their ability to think and strategies on how to improve their memories. If this is really a significant problem for them and it may be impairing their work, we might send them to a neuropsychologist to actually have some cognitive testing so we can sort out precisely where they're having problems. If they're having problems with their daily activities, they may see an occupational therapist that will help develop ways of managing their home activities, for instance, without getting fatigued. And lastly, we decided one of the things we wanted to help people do is to start looking at wellness after COVID. Like, okay, you've been sick as a dog. This has been terrible. Let's start looking at now, how do you go back to being a healthy person? We talk about things like healthy sleep. How do you get your brain to feel healthy again? How do you start resuming your activities in the community safely? And how do you deal with your emotions over having been so ill unexpectedly? The other thing that this does is it allows people who've experienced COVID to talk together about what their experiences have been. And that's been one, I think, one of the best things for them is they, first of all, figure out, I'm not crazy. There are other people that have gone through the same thing. And also get some good clues on how other people are dealing with some of the physical and mental symptoms that they are.
Is the goal cure, or is getting them to a point of being able to manage what they're going through?
Both. You know, most are going to get better. It's helping them get better faster and get better more completely. Some people can see the difference within 3 or 4 weeks. Having some guidance and knowing what they can do under supervision has really been helpful for them, because before they were afraid to do anything because they would feel bad and not know, you know, how to go forward.
So they just needed some help.
They needed some help in kind of navigating how to get better initially. For others, a small group of patients who really are perhaps going to have some very, very long-lasting effects, is really helping them navigate, you know, how do they get to doing what they want to do? How do they get their lives back with some difference in the way that they function?
Should COVID long haulers get the COVID-19 vaccine?
Anyone who's outside that 90-day window after having COVID should get the vaccine, because they are at risk for getting another infection. We have no reason to suspect they're not. And we think that having the vaccination would be far less damaging than having another infection.
Kathleen Bell, thank you so much for being with me.
And you can catch the Tuesday Health Watch every Tuesday on KRWG News at 6:45 during Morning Edition and 6:44 in the evening on All Things Considered. Well, we can't believe it's been a year. A year ago, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces. Every week, we are presenting portions of those interviews. Today, Korean War veteran Philip Leach is interviewed by his daughter, Pam Forte.
What was life like when you were growing up?
Oh, hungry half the time. I was a product of the Depression, so, you know, and then the war broke out, and my parents went to work in defense plants in Seattle at Boeing. Believe it or not, that made it better for us, because we had food regularly, a nice place to stay.
Now, what made you join the service?
Looking forward to a little better life.
And what branch of the service were you in?
The Air Force.
And what made you choose the Air Force?
Well, I'd always heard that the Army did a lot of marching. Mm-hmm. And I figured if I joined the Air Force, I wouldn't have to do that, but I was wrong.
How old were you when you went in?
19, if I remember correctly. You're asking a lot of my memory.
Well, what year did you go in?
June 15th, 1956. No, I'm sorry, 1952.
Yeah, I was going to say that didn't sound...
1956 is when I got out.
And then where were you stationed?
Denver for training.
Uh-huh.
And then they sent me to Fort Worth for more training. After my training, I was on B-36s.
And what was the nickname for that?
The Peacemaker.
Okay. What was your position on the plane?
I was a chief gunner. They were reactivating Biggs Air Force Base in El Paso, Texas. And the first plane to go there was a B-36 out of Fort Worth. And I was assigned to be on that plane.
Were you on that plane that went from Fort Worth to El Paso?
No.
Why?
They pulled me off because they figured they didn't need a full crew just to ferry a plane from Fort Worth to El Paso.
How many men were on the plane?
There were 14 on it, I think.
Okay. And what happened?
There was a snowstorm in El Paso. And there's also mountains. And they were circling over the mountains, and they couldn't see them because of the snowstorm. Mm-hmm. And ground control wasn't as sophisticated in those days as it is now. And they crashed the plane into the side of the mountain, flew it right straight in the mountain. And, of course, everybody was killed. And if I had been on it, I wouldn't be interviewing my daughter here right now.
That's right. You drove from Fort Worth to El Paso, right?
Yes. When they pulled me off, I didn't care because I was being transferred to El Paso anyway. So now I didn't know that that plane had crashed until I got here, or got there. Mm-hmm. After I went out to the base just to see it, and they told me that the plane had crashed. And so I called my parents in San Diego, my stepfather and my mother, and they were all upset because they knew I was supposed to be on that plane.
Already making funeral arrangements?
They were making funeral arrangements, yeah.
Wow. Did you enjoy it?
Yes. I enjoyed the Air Force. I met my wife on a blind date. They told me where she lived, gave me her address, and I just went there. She was a little bit shocked, I think.
Well, can I describe? Okay, well, what Mom told me was that she said no, she didn't want to go out on a blind date, and so you just decided to show up at her door, and when she answered it, her jaw just dropped because you were so handsome.
Well, that's true, I was.
And you were always the comedian in the family?
I guess. She used to get a kick out of the fact that the little neighborhood kids would come knock on the door and ask if I could come out and play. Because I used to go out and play baseball with them in the street.
So why did you retire?
I retired because Mom had her second stroke.
Mm-hmm.
It was a hemorrhagic stroke.
Right.
And I had to retire to take care of her. Now, I didn't want to retire. I was 82 years old, so I guess I was due.
Mm-hmm. You like living in El Paso?
Yes. When I got out of the service, when I was getting ready to get out, Mom and I were trying to decide where we wanted to live. My folks lived in San Diego at the time, and her folks lived in Rochester, New York. So we decided, let's stay here. And we did. You know, it only rains once a year in Seattle, but it starts in October and ends in March. Here, I love getting up in the morning and seeing the sun. It makes me feel good.
To hear this segment and the full interview with Philip Leach and other StoryCorps interviews, check out our StoryCorps page in the radio section at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More information at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. About 100,000 New Mexicans are receiving unemployment benefits. Many of those people lost their jobs due to the pandemic, and some of those jobs may not come back. But there are employment areas that are growing. New Mexico Department of Workforce Solutions Secretary Bill McCamley told KUNM's Khalil Ekulona about these growing areas, and he says now is the time to plan for what work will look like in the future.
There is going to be a light here at the end of the tunnel. Let's start thinking about how we get people back into the workforce and what that means.
Well, let me ask you that. Where are the jobs going to be here in New Mexico as we approach this light at the end of the tunnel?
So we actually know this for certain. There are four areas of economic growth in the state that we know are going to continue to add jobs for the next 10 years, and they are healthcare. We are going to need people from nursing assistants to brain surgeons. You are going to get a job, and you are going to help your community.
Okay.
Next one is education. We need teachers, and specifically, we need special education teachers, bilingual teachers, and folks that can teach math and science. Teacher salaries are going up, so you will make a decent salary. You will contribute to your economy. Third one is going to be STEM and IT. So we need engineers. We need technicians. We need folks that know how to do internet security like crazy. And as a lot of these jobs move to the virtual environment, we need more and more people that know how that system works. And you will be able to get a job in those areas. The last one is construction. Look, if you want to be an electrician, if you want to be a welder, if you want to be a carpenter, all those people are working right now. You can go work.
Is the Department of Workforce Solutions, are you working on or have any current programs in development that provide a system for people to go look at if they're interested in changing careers?
Yeah, so there's actually already a lot of money out there right now through what we call WIOA. That is a federal plan called Workforce Innovations and Opportunities Act.
Okay.
If you qualify for those funds, there's a couple different things you can qualify for. The first is, if you want to go get educated in one of these very high-need fields, you can apply at one of our local workforce board offices. There's another set of monies in that plan to help employers who want to hire on-the-job training opportunities. We can actually pay for like half of a salary for a worker if they're in a training program.
And as we consider economic recovery here in New Mexico, it's very, very hard to predict. Tell me, like with that eye on the light at the end of the tunnel, what do you think it's going to look like?
One of the things that I really applaud about Governor Lujan Grisham is she has been consistent in her message that our goal through this thing is going to be save the lives of New Mexicans. And what I would say to people is the more we get control of this virus, the more you go to vaccinenm.org, that is vaccinenm.org, and sign up to get vaccinated, the less risk there is for our health situation, the more we're going to be able to open up the economy. And we'll be doing what we want to do, which is get people back into their jobs. And so that's number one. Two, Khalil, I think the bigger question is going to be, as we examine the leap that our economic situation has taken during this thing, what's that going to mean for the economy? We still need to figure that out. And I'll give you an example. COVID comes out. We need to get people working from home. We got everyone working from home within 2 or 3 weeks. That's just a small example of the kind of changes that may be happening in the economy. But I think we need to look at things like the skill sets people need to be able to get online. Broadband access is obviously a huge deal. And then equipment. Do people have the computers that they need to be able to participate in this economy? And what's that going to mean for everybody else?
As we go along on this process, I'm sure new revelations will come up. I'll be the first to give you a line. He is the Secretary of Workforce Solutions, Bill McCamley. Thanks so much for being back on the show.
Thanks a lot, Khalil. Everybody keeping your heads up out there. We're going to get through this sucker together.
The national battle over social media bans has come to the Texas legislature. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is backing a bill that seeks to ban social media companies from censoring users based on their views. Republican lawmakers have been stepping up their criticism of the online platforms ever since companies like Twitter and Facebook banned former President Trump following the deadly U.S. Capitol riot. Abbott recently appeared with fellow Republican Brian Hughes, the state senator who filed the legislation.
Big tech's efforts to silence conservative viewpoints is un-American, un-Texan, and it is unacceptable, and pretty soon it's going to be against the law in the state of Texas.
Senate Bill 12 is also a top priority for Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, but legal experts say that this idea will not pass muster. Privately owned platforms can regulate content. The First Amendment, they note, deals with the government regulating speech. The New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project is a collaboration between anthropologists at New Mexico State University and the Oral History Program at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces. The goal of the project was to record the memories of New Mexicans who grew up in rural parts of the state in the first half of the 20th century. This episode explores what it meant to work, save, and go shopping in different parts of the state.
Living in rural New Mexico in the early 1900s meant that goods and services weren't easily accessible. People would need to travel several miles into town for their shopping needs. Trading posts to barter various goods were also a good option in these remote parts. Another thing that made it tough was trying to find steady work to make a living wage. In this episode, we'll explore the commerce of rural New Mexico. Lebeo Martinez was born in 1930 in Dixon, New Mexico. He grew up in the same house he still lives in today. He describes how much money people used to make and the cost of attending school in the 30s.
People used to work for a dollar a day. Even the mission teachers that came from back east, that all they got paid was $30 a month. But they charged tuition $2 a month. So my dad had to pay, work 2 days somewhere for $2 to pay my tuition. Actually, my brother and sister, the same thing. So he needed $6 a month to pay our tuition to go to the mission school.
Daniel Olguin and his family moved to Washington Ranch in 1944, where he lived until 1951, when he left to join the Air Force.
Right after I got out of the Air Force, I worked on the cotton gin, and I was the one that, you know, it has a big old tube about this big around, and had two handles, and it sucks the cotton up into where it was ginning, and it separates the seed from the fiber. I worked on that one season, and it paid $1 an hour. And that was big money. And you, like, if a trailer came in with two bales, you'd cut it in half. I was the one that, you know, sucked up all the cotton and stuff. Once in a while, there'd be a box of matches that would be sucked into the deal, and it'd cause a fire inside. So there was an alarm going off, you know, if there's a fire, and they stopped everything. But anyway. And it was a job because you jumped off of one trailer, run into another one, and then start all over again. And you'd work all day, and sometimes you'd work all night.
Cotton has been an important part of New Mexico's economy for centuries and has become a major commercial crop for the state. Lucille Wolf, who was born in Artesia in 1925, also recalls the cotton industry in Atoka, just outside of Artesia.
The store was across the road from a cotton gin. The farmers would bring in their cotton bollies and wagons, and they had a weighing station where they weighed it. Then they separated the cotton from the bollies, and the gin spit out the seeds of the cotton bollies into a big barn.
Felipe Baca was born in 1928 and spent most of his childhood living in La Cienega and Galisteo. When times were tough, families might resort to selling livestock. Felipe gives an example of a neighbor that needed to do just that, although the money received was not exactly put away safely in a bank.
Well, this man, you know, he only had, like I said, a daughter and a son. And before he died, he sold all his sheep and cattle. And he didn't believe in banks. So he kept all the money at home. So he went and buried it across I-25, which was then US 85. He used to go bury it over there under a tree for all the money that he got for the cattle and the sheep, you know. And then when he was dying, he kept telling Dad, "Cousin, I'm going to tell you something so that you and my daughter and son will never have to worry about being short of money and financial things. I went in, he'd get to a certain point, and then he wouldn't come out with it. You know, he never told him. Well, he finally just died and never told him what the deal was. And I imagine, I think he was probably trying to tell where and how to get to that money that he buried so that he could divide it between the son and the daughter and some for himself. And that's what he was trying to imply, you know. But he never got to do it. He died before he could say.
Besides working for an hourly wage, bartering goods was also a way to provide for the family. Once again, Labeo Martinez.
We go in a horse and wagon up the road to Gagnasco, which is 12, 13, 14 miles from here. And we take a bunch of fruit, you know, plums, pears, apples, whatever we had, melons, chili, whatever, and trade it for pumpkins and beans and peas and stuff like that.
Okay.
Even for chickens.
Amado Mares, born in 1934, talks about his father growing crops to trade. They also grew hay to feed livestock.
He used to plant a lot of potatoes to barter and provide. He grew his own hay in the meadows here. So everything that he did was barter. Cash never came in until October when the calves would sell and the lambs. But that with that cash, we keep them over the winter, I guess. In September, October, they had to cut the hay to feed the cattle and the sheep during the 5 months of the winter. So my father would give them, he'd bring in a couple of laborers and give them hay, give them a lamb or a cow or something, and they would do the work along with my mother. Mother would, she would cook the meals for all the laborers.
Bronson Springstead was born in 1936 in Chaco Canyon. His father, who went by the nickname Colonel, owned a trading post.
Everything else that they traded for, goods, they paid off in the fall with lambs, wool, mohair, pelts, rugs, jewelry, whatever they could make. The payday was in the fall. They paid all their accounts in the fall. So I can remember, they would take me out of school because he would have 5,000 head of lambs that we had to drive to Gallup to the railroad.
Monty Shriver was born in El Dorado in 1934 and grew up in Aztec, New Mexico. There were 2 drugstores, 3 grocery stores, and a bank. Grocery stores at that time worked on credit because farmers didn't always have cash.
And you could charge groceries in. They would write down, each of them had their little books, and they could write down each item and what the price was, and then you would charge it. The farmers didn't always have money, so they would charge it, and then after a while they'd start bugging you for a little money. And what was funny, certainly since Harfield and Don Gay would stand outside their business to see who was going into which store to charge groceries. If your bill got a little high here, or then you'd go into Gay's, or you'd go into Hubbard's.
We come back to Lucille Wolf, whose father owned general stores in Atoka and later in Alamogordo and Deming.
My father sold everything. He had a grease rack, and he sold gasoline, and he had kerosene. He had vinegar by the barrel people bought in. Quart jars and got vinegar. He sold shoes, he sold car batteries, he sold tires, he sold material, thread, he had a meat market, he sold cigarettes and stuff like that. He also sold fencing to the farmers because they could bring it in on the train. And the farmers could unload it into their wagons and take the fence back home. So Dad sold everything. It was a general mercantile.
Mary Ellen Warren was born in 1927 on the Sierra Grande Ranch. Her family would go 10 miles north into Deming, New Mexico to run their errands.
At the time that I was growing up, they had, I think, 3 grocery stores, and they had a hardware store. They had a drug store, and they had a telephone office, which got all the telephone. You know, it was one of those plug-in things. I know we used to order, maybe it was from Montgomery Ward, I don't know, things like prunes, and they'd come in the big box. But usually we went to Clayton to buy our groceries a lot of times. We just get essentials at Des Moines. Of course, flour and sugar, salt, those were the main things that we bought because we pretty well had everything.
Lonnie Harper was born in 1936. In this clip, he gives insight into stores keeping food fresh in the 1940s.
They had the first to come out that I remember in the late 40s was your grocery stores, your little country grocery stores, put in what we call frozen food locker plants. And they would put in maybe a block of 50 to 100 little compartments, a big room that was refrigerated and kept it probably 15 to 20 degrees below zero, the whole room. And then you have a locker that you'd rent for $50 a year or something like that. And they'd freezer wrap, you know, your meat and put it in the freezer. And it'd last about a year without freezer burn. And that really helped the butchering business. And my dad and one of my older brothers, they later had, my oldest brother actually later ran his own little slaughter plant. He did it up at Farmington, New Mexico for about 20 years, where he would go out and slaughter an animal for all the farmers for their own freezer. And then he'd cut and wrap it and put it into a quick freeze, and he'd charge them so much for cutting and wrapping. And he'd take it by the order, you know, how big, how thick you like your steaks, and how big a package to make your hamburger meat in, too.
Besides freezers, canning has been a way to preserve food since the early 1800s. Daniel Olkin recalls trips to the grocery store to fill up his truck with canned goods.
With $12, you could fill the back end of the pickup with canned goods or flour and all kinds of stuff, $10 to $15. And now, with $15, you can just carry them in one little bag. Things where a box of matches was 5 cents. And now I think it's like 3 boxes for about $5, something like that. I buy them about 3 boxes in one bundle. And so things have changed so drastic.
Monty Shriver returns once again to describe mail order catalogs, a precursor to our modern online shopping. Although many things have changed since the early 1900s, one thing that hasn't is being a kid on Christmas.
We had the Sears and Roebuck catalog, mm-hmm. and the Montgomery catalog. And the big thing was when it was getting to be Christmas time, we would always pour through those catalogs and point out to our folks what we wanted as a gift. Yeah, that was a big thing. Thanks for reminding me about catalogs. And of course, catalogs were recycled at the outhouses.
That concludes this episode of the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. All interviews were conducted or supervised by Kelly Jenks, Mary Alice Scott, Kayla Archuleta Brown, and Mariah Ballard. On behalf of New Mexico State University, I'm Jose Loera. Thank you for tuning in.
That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, this is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. Join us all weekend long and anytime for that matter for the latest news, local viewpoints, and more at the region's homepage, krwg.org.